From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
With protesters in the halls and even the hearing room, and the country bitterly divided politically, a rancorous confirmation hearing was held this week for Judge Brett Kavanaugh to become the next justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. EWTN News Nightly's Capitol Hill correspondent Jason Calvey joins us with a full report. And in the midst of the sexual abuse crisis, calls are growing for an extraordinary synod of bishops to weigh in. Register correspondent Stephen Beal gives us the details. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. And I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, the Register's senior editor and my co-host here in studio in Birmingham. Welcome, Matthew.
Always a rare treat to be down here in Birmingham with you. And right now, I think Washington, D.C. isn't a bad place to be away from.
That's absolutely true, isn't it? We'll be turning in our next segment to the crisis surrounding Archbishop Theodore McCarrick, the Pennsylvania grand jury report, and those details that still linger in our minds, and of course, the most recent letter of Archbishop Carlo Vigano accusing Pope Francis of covering up for Theodore McCarrick. And you know, in the midst of this atmosphere, Catholics are wondering if a special synod might be needed, and some bishops have called for that. And we'll turn to that later. But first, we will talk to Jason Calvey. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jeanette.
So, Jason, you have been there. You have witnessed the hearings this week. And from what I've seen from a distance, the atmosphere has been quite intense. Can you describe it for us?
It's absolutely intense. And as we, you know, every couple minutes of the first day, the first 75 minutes, they were supposed to break into opening statements. And the chairman, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, was supposed to give his opening statement. But for the first 75 minutes, it was one delay after the other between the protesters, the hecklers that were in the crowd of the public, where the public can sit. The American people are invited to come in and watch government in action. And they would, you know, from time to time, somebody would stand up and say, you know, women's rights or any other number of chants that they had. And they would be escorted and arrested by the police. 70 people arrested the first day, 77 the second day. So that was the first 75 minutes, all these protesters. But then also the Democrats were continuing to put up all these obstacles because they said they didn't get enough time to review these documents. 42,000 documents from Judge Kavanaugh's time in the Bush White House were released just the day before the hearing began. And they said they needed more time to look at this, and they wanted to adjourn the meeting, and they wanted to delay this hearing from actually happening this week.
And how do you think Judge Kavanaugh fared in the course of this, first of all, the theatrics, but also, you know, in the questioning?
It was pretty incredible, the fact that he was able to stay composed as, you know, 70 people each day were, first day 77, the next day were arrested and taken out and shouting at the top of their lungs. And he kept his composure and tried his best to just focus on what the senators were saying. But at certain times, the senators couldn't even ask their questions because they were so overwhelmed by the loud crowd, you know, about 50 to 100 feet behind them, which is where the public is seated for these confirmation hearings.
Jason, what are the expectations? I mean, it has been reported that it would be difficult for this not to go through. But what are you hearing now?
Yeah, so it's going to be difficult because the Republicans have, you know, the majority. They have 51 seats. Senator McCain, as we know, has died, and we ask for eternal rest for him. But he's been replaced by a former Arizona senator, John Kyle. And what's interesting about that pick is John Kyle is the one who actually chauffeured Judge Brett Kavanaugh through the Senate chambers. There's always a senior person, a former senator, for example, who will take that role of introducing the judge during what they call courtesy visits. So for the whole summer, actually, Judge Kavanaugh has been doing the rounds, meeting with various senators from both parties. And Senator Kyle was the one that did that. And now he's taking the spot of John McCain, who's died. And now so Republicans have that 51 seat majority. What also is at stake here is there are two Republicans who support abortion. That's Lisa Murkowski, of Alaska and mm-hmm. Susan Collins of Maine, they both support abortion. And as we know, because Judge Brett Kavanaugh is replacing the swing vote on abortion, he's replacing Anthony Kennedy, who's retiring. Everybody knows that this nomination could have a drastic impact on abortion in our country moving forward. So that's why this has been a huge part of these confirmation hearings. The questions, have a lot of them have been about abortion and about Roe v. Wade in particular. And so I think looking at it, I think a lot of people think this confirmation is going to go forward. He's going to be confirmed. There are three Democrats who voted for Judge Neil Gorsuch. So those three Democrats possibly will again vote for Judge Brett Kavanaugh. So we'll see when that actually happens in the next month.
I always love the term that they use for someone like John Kyle, if he was serving as Sherpa The nominee, in this case, Brett Kavanaugh, as though you have to be prepared to climb Mount Everest.
And
I use that analogy because it seems at times that the process of the last week of watching one Democrat after another, and in fairness, the Republicans do it when it's a Democrat nominee, but one Democrat after another essentially trying to tear him to pieces with the different arguments, but also with the fine points of law and emails and background and all of this. We both covered Neil Gorsuch, and we both covered now Brett Kavanaugh. How would you compare Kavanaugh's performance to Gorsuch's performance? And did Kavanaugh do as well as he needed to?
I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting, but both Gorsuch, Judge Gorsuch, or now Justice Gorsuch, and Judge Brett Kavanaugh, is they're both very well composed. Even when we'd mention these protesters, the hecklers, we'd mention these really intense questioning that some of the senators have leveled at both of those two men. They've stayed composed, and I think that helps them as the American people are watching these hearings on cable throughout the day, or checking it on EWTN News Nightly or one of the other newscasts. They see some of the highlights, but he's been able to keep his voice calm even in the midst of screaming protesters and very difficult questions from the senators. So I think that plays well for him in the eyes of the American people. And you know, looking at these, I think there's about five senators whose votes are really up for grabs. The two Republicans who support abortion, which I just mentioned, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, and then the three Democrats who voted for Gorsuch. So that's Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and then Joe Manchin of West Virginia. They all voted for Neil Gorsuch. And I think, you know, having the fact that he's so well composed, that might help the people back home then say, you know, I like this guy, I like Judge Kavanaugh. And then, you know, that might lead those senators to vote yes in the confirmation vote.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, he strikes people, I think, as pretty likable. Neil Gorsuch kind of dazzled you with his intellect.
Right.
He made everyone else in the committees look like mental pygmies compared to him. With Brett Kavanaugh, he was just more approachable and more likable. But what were some of the key issues that the Democrats brought up and that the Republicans brought up that you think were most important coming out of this confirmation hearing?
Yeah, one of the most important issues, again and again, that was brought up by both sides of the aisle was the issue of Roe v. Wade, particularly the Democrats bringing that issue up and really trying to have him weigh, what is he going to do when he's on the Supreme Court? How is he going to decide a future abortion case? And one of the things that Judge Kavanaugh said again and again, he used Justice Kagan's line from her confirmation hearing, she's not going to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And then also hearkening back to the tradition of the most, you know, all the current justices not answering, forecasting how they're going to rule when they hear a case. They say that would really hurt their independence, and they need to be able to hear the specifics of a particular case in the future, and they can't really weigh in on those issues now. So that's what Judge Kavanaugh said again and again. He wasn't going to forecast. He wasn't going to give any issues a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and that's kind of how he answered those abortion cases. But he did say, you know, it is settled law. Roe v. Wade is settled law. It's precedent. And then he made this turn of phrase, precedent upon precedent, meaning that Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which reaffirmed Roe v. Wade, is a second precedent, adding upon precedent that Roe v. Wade has been reaffirmed so many times by the Supreme Court. So it is an important precedent of the court.
I always remember the exchange that Dianne Feinstein had I think, with Sam Alito. Do you consider this a super precedent? And Alito retorted something like a super duper precedent?
Exactly. I don't know if they use that in the law school books.
Right, exactly. You know, we're almost out of time. I did want to ask one question. How are pro-life groups responding to Kavanaugh's responses this week?
So actually, there is a pro-life group right now in Alabama. The Susan B. Anthony list, I know, had a demonstration in Alabama because one of the senators who I didn't mention is the Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Alabama Senator Doug Jones is one who some pro-lifers are hoping will vote yes on Judge Kavanaugh. He's new to the Senate. Mm-hmm. He took the place of Senator Luther Strange, who was a temporary replacement for Jeff Sessions. And so he hasn't voted on, he did not vote for Neil Gorsuch. He wasn't here at that time. So there is some speculation that, you know, these pro-lifers are hoping that they'll get Senator Jones to vote for the judge. So we'll have to wait and see. That's something they're pushing for right now. And I know pro-lifers are also making the case with ads and also door knocking in places like Indiana and West Virginia. Those senators who did vote for Gorsuch, they're really hoping again will vote for Judge Kavanaugh to become Supreme Court Justice.
And when is the vote expected?
The vote is expected this month because they want to have him take the Supreme Court. They want to have him take a seat at the Supreme Court at the beginning of the term, which the first day of the term is October 1st. So they really want to have that confirmation vote this month of September, so he can be on October 1st.
Well, Jason Calvi from EWTN News Nightly, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we talk to Stephen Beal, a Register correspondent, about the calls for an extraordinary synod of bishops. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Marcus Groda.
I believe EWTN's National Catholic Register is unique from other newspapers in that it not only is committed to reporting the news from the world and the church and our faith, but it does so through the lens of the faithfulness of our Catholic Church.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner or call 1-800-421-3230.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register here in Birmingham studio with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. And we are joined by Stephen Beal, a Register correspondent who's on the line. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Stephen, you have written a story about these calls for an extraordinary synod, which many people have no idea really what that means, except for the fact that we recently had a couple of synods. But this synod, right, this call for a synod, it relates to the current crisis of the church and the idea that there needs to be a focus on the life and the ministry of the clergy, bishops, priests, deacons, seminarians, on this whole group. There needs to be an understanding or a discussion around their lives in this time of crisis. So first off, tell us who has made these calls, and we'll start there.
Sure. I think these calls have kind of come from around both sides of the Atlantic. So we have Bishop Egan in Portsmouth, England, who wrote a letter earlier in August to Pope Francis calling, he was the first to call for this kind of a synod, and he kind of outlined in detail what he thought its agenda should be. His letter was echoed about a week later from the bishop in Dallas, Bishop Burns, and then also Archbishop Charles Triput of Philadelphia called for it as well, though his letter has not been made public. His remarks were reported by LifeSite News. We don't know what's in his letter, but presumably the same kind of a call for an extraordinary synod.
Absolutely, and in fact, he seemed to be talking about also the possibility of canceling postponing the youth synod, which is expected here in October. although we have not been able to get confirmations on Archbishop Chaput's, what the letter said. He didn't make it public as the others did, Bishop Burns and Bishop Egan did publish their letters. So I guess we'll wait to see if Archbishop Chaput will publish his letter. But let's start with another rudimentary question. What exactly are they calling for, an extraordinary synod? What does that entail?
Well, an extraordinary synod is a permanent body of bishops. It's a bit smaller than an ordinary synod, but which is also a body of bishops that meets. The extraordinary synod is meant to address matters that require a speedy resolution, so it tends to be smaller and more nimble. The ordinary synod of bishops, as I said, is more of a permanent body. It meets typically every 3 years, deal with more routine affairs that don't need to be addressed so quickly. And this whole idea of a synod of bishops meeting, representing the whole church, is something that emerges out of the Second Vatican Council. It's this whole idea of collegiality, a church where the bishops are more involved in governing the church structure and less of a top-down approach to governance. So that's where this whole idea of a synod came from. The extraordinary synods, we've only had a few of those, so this would be, I believe, the fourth one. We've only had three so far.
And Matthew, you're the church historian. How many synods, regular synods, have we had?
Well, every 3 years, essentially from the late 1960s. And they have covered every conceivable topic from the Bible and the life, scripture and the life of the church, and Pope Benedict, the new evangelization. Most recently, of course, we had the extraordinary synod on the family in 2014, and then we had the ordinary synod on the family in 2015. If people think of the of a synod, extraordinary or otherwise, it's probably most the one that's sort of burned into our memories, because the fruit of both of those was the exhortation Amoris Laetitia.
That's right. That's right. And just to point out again what Stephen said, it's that an extraordinary synod, as canon law says, is for speedy resolution or speedy remedy to a crisis or an issue. And when Pope Francis called for the synod, extraordinary synod on the family, he felt it was just an intense moment for the family, and that needed to be looked at in haste, in urgency. And the same is, it can be said of this moment right now, that this needs to be examined in haste and in with urgency. But Stephen, you talked to several theologians and canonists who didn't actually agree that this was the right move for the moment. What did they have to say?
Well, they raised a lot of concerns, and many of them initially were open to it, but as they thought about it, they had second thoughts. So one issue is that even though this is supposed to be a very quick way of responding to crises, it still takes a lot of time to organize an extraordinary synod. You are pulling people from all over the world. There's just a lot of logistics that goes into that, and it's not really practical to hold that while you also have two other ordinary synods planned. I think one was mentioned earlier on the youth, and there's one in 2019 in the Pan-Amazon area. And one of my sources believes that those two would have to be canceled, and he questions whether that's practical. So you have the issue of whether it's practical. You also have the issue of this being an advisory body. Synods don't legislate. All they do is recommend, and it's really up to the Pope to accept the recommendations and turn them into legislation for the Church. Well, he can do that now. He doesn't have to wait for a synod to act. So some people say, given the urgency of this, let's have the Pope step in now, especially because the Pope is the person who really is authorized to judge cardinals, bishops, and archbishops. And as we know from the recent news, this problem rises all the way to the top, even to the level of a cardinal.
Well, you know, we had a recent interview with Bishop Egan. And this was done by one of our British correspondents, K.B. Turley. And in that interview, it was very interesting. I mean, he felt that even though it would take time to prepare, you know, and from the practical sense, that kind of preparation would be needed, like that that the depth of this problem is so great that it needs this kind of response. That was his take, you know. Synod, while it's supposed to be a speedy solution or resolution, it also involves a lot of conversation. It involves a lot of discussion. And if I'm not wrong, Matthew, it involves experts, right?
It does. The technical term is a peritus or a periti. So those would need to be brought in. But then there's that added question, and Stephen, you can address this as well, on the role of laity in any sort of an extraordinary synod that's going to try to deal with a massive problem involving the sex abuse crisis and the accountability of bishops. Because one of the things that even I've heard people float is this idea of a very extraordinary synod of lay people rather than an extraordinary synod for lay people. Stephen?
Yes. Well, I think that is one of the issues with having a synod right now is that, again, you do have a credibility issue with just bishops trying to solve the problem when many people view bishops as part of the problem. That's why some people are suggesting turning to Pope Francis or looking at other alternatives to addressing this crisis.
Absolutely. And what were some of the other alternatives that were floated with the theologians that you spoke with?
Well, one of them was that we do have a congregation for the clergy. One of my sources said this is an ordinary vehicle that we can use. They have bishops who are members of this. They have a cardinal prefect. They're in a position to get together and meet on a regular basis, and they're all ready to act on this. And so the suggestion was that they should update the guidance that they issue for the life of the clergy to incorporate the reforms that are necessary right now.
And Matthew, a very good friend of yours who has really been an advisor to the Register in some of our understanding of these kind of things, Monsignor William King, has written a piece for the Register about this very question. He doesn't seem to be too favorable to the calls right now for an extraordinary synod. What did he have to say?
Well, his point is very similar to what some of these theologians and canonists are making, is that there's a question of accountability, there's a question of credibility, there's a question also of structure, and that it always goes back to that sort of fundamental question about synods. What exactly is their authority? In much the same way that in the pontificate of Pope Francis, we've seen the elevation of episcopal conferences, the idea of synodality, of journeying together under Pope Francis, has assumed a very different kind of weight than under previous popes, and of course, especially John Paul II, who presided over many, many different synods, but never really saw them as having the kind of authority that, that Pope Francis seems to want it to have. So there are a lot of canonical questions, theological questions, and then, of course, as Stephen's great article points out, these are just practical problems.
Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there some changes to the synod process by Pope Francis recently to give it more weight?
Yes. So one of the things that Pope Francis tried to emphasize was that, especially under Cardinal Lorenzo Baldessari, I think, who's the current General Secretary of the Synod, he makes the point that instead of having everything, all of the work done before the synod actually starts, to have more involvement of the bishops who are taking part. Now, that brings its own risks, as we saw with the Extraordinary Synod in 2014 and in 2015, because you don't know what you're going to get at the end of the day. And instead of the prepared statements, which we usually would see, where there'd be a formal discussion of the documents that were already sort of in hand, here the expectation on the part of the Holy Father is that these groups of bishops, especially done by geographical region, are going to produce documents, and then out of this sort of synergy, the synodality, we'll end up with a final statement.
It's very interesting.
Again, it's filled with the risk.
Right. Right. Now, I think, Stephen, in your piece, there was one of the theologians. I mean, most of them seem to have more skepticism than praise for this call. But one of them did say, you know, this is weighty enough. It deserves this kind of discussion. Were any of them thinking that more bishops might be calling for this? I mean, so far there's only been three. What have you heard about the murmurings of possibly other calls?
You know, I didn't get that sense from people I spoke with, that there's going to be this rising chorus of bishops. I think the people that I spoke with expect Pope Francis to act, but there's not a great expectation that there's going to be a lot of other bishops rallying around the three bishops we've talked with already.
Well, I guess we'll await their responses. Of course, many, many people have been awaiting Pope Francis's response to this, the totality of the crisis that we are facing in the U.S. And as he has in other places such as Chile. So this is a critical moment, and I think it is a moment that we are, in a way, all ears, awaiting the leadership, and that also requires a lot of prayer, because we're journalists. We're trying to get to the bottom of this, but we're also people of faith, and so we join them in prayer. Stephen, thank you so much for your article and for your writing for the Register.
Thank you.
Remember to go to ncregister.com to look up Stephen's article on this extraordinary synod and the responses of theologians to this call. For more news and analysis, check out the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.
For information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.